Well, good morning. Welcome to the Education Committee for Thursday, February 13th. please put your cell phones on silent if you have them with you. And Ann, please call the roll.
Chair O'Toole.
Here.
Vice Chair Porter.
Here.
Ranking Member Reed.
Here.
Representative Atkins.
Here.
Beleka.
Here.
Coley.
Here.
Danish.
Here.
Diaz.
Woodward.
Hudson, McBurney,
here.
Nunez,
here.
Perry,
here.
Peters,
here.
Saunders,
here.
Stafford,
here.
Torres,
here.
Zimmerman.
Here.
We have a quorum.
We have a quorum. A couple of those heres were not like the usual here. It was sort of Representative Saunders. I'm speaking of you. You sounded a little tired today.
Tired.
Do you have that chocolate there to eat?
Well, I got some.
All right. I seen him at the last meeting over there. He was tired then, too, wasn't he, Representative Nunez? Well, that's okay. Welcome to everyone in the audience. Thank you for being here. I believe there's only two committee meetings this day, and it was Representative Nunez and ours. So we're going to try to move right into it. Today we are going to workshop round two of draft language for the early learning bill. Now, I know many of you have been up here all week meeting and having workshops, etc., so I appreciate your time and attention to this matter. Since our last meeting, we've met with numerous stakeholders, and I know many of you know that because you were there. In working on this bill, I asked everyone to measure their idea against four guiding principles. All providers that participate in school readiness, or VPK, should be held to a certain level of health and safety standards. Two, VPK and school readiness personnel should be well qualified. C, parents should be given information so they can make informed choices. And D, fiscal impacts to the state and to the providers should be minimized. In your packet today, you have a summary chart and a copy of the revised draft. Now, some of you got copies of materials already, and hopefully you've had time to look at them. Kathy's going to walk us through the chart, because as you can hear, I've got a frog. Kathy, you're ready to go.
Thank you, Chair O'Toole. Members, first I really need to thank Jason Fudge and Gavin Beagle, who have done all of the writing and rewriting and re-rewriting as we've taken input and have done a really great job putting this together for you. And they have color-coded both the bill and the chart for you, so as we're going through, you can follow along. If you look at the chart that we provided, the first column is the section of the bill. The second column is your line reference, the statute amended, the general topic, and then changes. Anything that's highlighted in yellow is new in this version from the version that we reviewed last time. So I'm not going to go through all the stuff that's the same as last time. There are a couple of major changes to the bill and then a lot of smaller issues that were brought to us by some of the providers and advocates. The guiding principles that the chair just discussed are also on the chart for your reference, as well as any other folks that you meet with between now and next week. So starting on section one of the bill, there was a request, and we have changed the term family daycare home to family child care home. In section two of the bill, this is a new section. If the bill section number is highlighted in yellow, that means it's a new section in the bill. This amends the Rilla Wilson Act, which currently applied to children from age three to school entry, to apply to children from birth to school entry. It requires a child who the law already requires a child who is enrolled in a program as part of their casework to attend for 5 days. So we have just changed that so that it would cover infants to age three as well. The purpose of that, of course, is if the child isn't there for a couple of consecutive days, someone has to notify DCF. Section 3 and 4, there were no changes to the zoning statutes. Section 5 is the first place that you see the major change in the bill, so I need to take a minute and describe that change. when we were together last time, the options on the table for providers in school readiness and VPK were that you were either licensed or you were accredited by a body that met or exceeded the licensure standards as determined by DCF. After that meeting, we met with a lot of folks. DCF had concerns about how they would implement that, about reviewing accreditors, about making that determination. The accreditors themselves had concerns about new accreditors starting who might not be good quality. And some of the accredited institutions had concerns about the way we did it. So working with everyone, we are bringing you a new proposal. And this is to go into existing law, and I want to stress that. This is existing law in Section 402.302, which requires substantial compliance with licensure standards for non-public schools. So working with DCF, we've gone into that section, and we have defined substantial compliance for the purposes of those who participate in school readiness and VPK. So we've tried to narrow down just a little bit the scope of those licensure standards for this purpose. You can see them listed there in yellow, supervision, transportation, and so forth. And then we made a statement because this was of concern to some of the non-public schools, particularly faith-based schools, that there's nothing in this requirement that addresses curriculum. No one is allowed to go in and inspect their curriculum. So again, we've tried to identify the standards related to health and safety and require substantial compliance. This does authorize DCF to then make sure, inspect, so forth, that they are complying. So five is the definition of substantial compliance, and then six is where you see it applied to non-public schools. We also added a little language there that this is not intended to expand the regulatory scope of the state, the early learning coalitions, or anyone. We're not trying to do anything more than establish substantial compliance with health and safety standards. And then it authorizes DCF or in those counties that locally license to enforce this. You'll see this change again as we get a little further in the bill for exempt institutions as well. Section 7 of the bill, we made a slight change there. This is how you know people are reading the bill, when they note that you put first cousins and they want to know why it wasn't all cousins. So now it's all cousins and grandparents if you transfer ownership, and we're glad people read the bills. And then there's currently in law a requirement that when an employee is fired for some egregious offense, that the place where they worked has to disclose that information. But there was not a requirement in law that the person hiring them had to ask. So we tried to close the loop, and this was, again, at the request of some of the providers so that we could have an opportunity for really egregious behavior to be identified and shared. There's still a level of discomfort for some folks around that, so we're going to continue to work through that. But the intention was to make sure that we weren't hiring folks who had already had some serious offenses in a prior location. Section 8 simply authorizes DCF to conduct the inspections of facilities for that substantial compliance that we talked about. Section 9, we made a slight change here, even though it's not in yellow, because we removed something. You may recall that with regard to DCF inspections, we were requiring them to develop a risk-based approach to inspection. We've removed that from the bill, and we've simply required them to go ahead and implement what they call abbreviated inspections, which should have the effect of shortening and limiting their inspections based on the judgment that they have. So that was at their request. And Section 10, this is family daycare homes requiring that they be licensed if they offer school readiness or VPK, and authorizing DCF to inspect. And then there's this issue in law that you have to give people their flu brochures in August and September. And apparently people get flu in other months. So the flu brochure will be given to parents at the time they enroll. Item 11 is a change to large family child care homes to make sure that they are charged residential utility rates as opposed to commercial. That's intended to be cheaper and save them money. And the same flu brochure requirement for enrollment. Section 12 is where you have substantial compliance applied to exempt providers. So even those providers who in the past have been exempt from any form of licensure will now be required to substantially comply, same things that we talked about earlier. No changes to 13 with regard to property insurance. Change 14, you may recall that we've authorized early learning coalitions to identify providers that they think have the ability to determine child eligibility for VPK themselves. We just wanted to clarify that if that occurs, that provider is responsible for keeping records, responsible for any errors, and those things have to be audited. Section 15 is school year VPK for private providers. We are trying to be sensitive to the issue that some of the private providers have brought us about duplicative inspections and duplicative processes. So we're requiring the coalitions, OEL and DCF, to work together to try to reduce or minimize those things. We've put back all of the items we took out on accreditation because we're no longer using that methodology. So those are the changes that you see here. And then we are making a statement that in current law it says that providers have to meet basic health and safety requirements, and this applies substantial compliance to them and makes it clear that it's DCF's role and not the coalition's. And then at the very bottom of page 3, which is section 15, you'll remember the discussion about a provider that had a level 1, which is the worst violation, that they would not be able to be renewed. There were some concerns that seemed to be really legitimate, that if it was an offense that an employee committed and they fired the employee that day, that they shouldn't be penalized by not being able to operate for a year. So we are trying to do two things here. One is to encourage self-reporting by the providers when something like this occurs, that if they have reported it to OEL and taken care of the problem, then OEL is authorized to allow them to be to renew their contract for the next year. And then lastly, we make clear again that workers' comp and unemployment compensation are not required for folks who are already exempt under law, and that is primarily religious and faith-based providers. Sections 16 and 17 are about VPK, summer VPK in Section 16 and school year VPK in 17. The same provision. Last time we talked about being clear that if a charter school wants to authorize a VPK program, it could be part of their contract with the school district, and it would be then under the jurisdiction and oversight of the school district's program. We have added here that a charter school who is not authorized to do that or who doesn't want to do it that way may still offer a VPK program as a private provider, but they will then have to meet all the requirements that we've just reviewed for private providers. Section 18, after the presentation you received on attendance and the importance of attendance, especially some of the kindergarten readiness rate data that we've seen for children who completed the program and that sort of thing. We are requiring providers to give parents information about the program that's being provided and the importance of the children's attendance and what they are doing on a daily basis. And then also asking providers or requiring them to contact parents when a child is absent for 2 consecutive days without any knowledge of why that child is absent. In Section 20, a very slight change to the Early Learning Advisory Council to that any input they provide to the executive director will be written input so that there will be a record of it so that it can be shared. No changes to some of the fixes in 21 and 22 and 23. Section 24, this probably should, we did not change the existing priority for these children. What we did is change the eligibility. So on the priority list for school readiness, children with special needs are in the same place, but we have changed the eligibility age from 3 to 5 to 0 to 5. So it expands the eligibility category for those children who from birth to 3. So it goes on from birth to 5. And then we came all the way back around on the issue of siblings. We started in this position with siblings before they when they were eligible to enter sixth grade, and then people said, well, what if they got, you know, if they were, then we went to ages. We wanted to do 13. Well, 13 was too old, so then we wanted to do 11. Well, what if they got retained? So now we've come back around to say it revises the eligibility so that they are eligible until they enter sixth grade. The intent here is to keep the services focused on the youngest. Section 25, this is the same application of substantial compliance to private providers in school readiness. Continuing in that section, there was a requirement that the providers had to include the Early Learning Coalition as an insured party. It's our determination that the coalitions are covered by sovereign immunity and do not need to be included, so we remove that requirement. Again, no workers' comp if you're not required by law to have it. Same requirement for program information for parents and contact if children are absent for 2 days. And there were no changes to the rest of the draft, Madam Chair, so that's the chart.
Thank you, Kathy, and I do want to thank all of you out in the audience because I feel like you're part of the staff for having come in and helped us with this bill, and I want to thank the staff because this has been ours. And if you think back to when Representative Saunders first said to us, and I think Representative McBurney is, you know, we really ought to look at early learning and tighten up the health and safety. Who would know all of the things that we have done to make this a better place for children, which is the ultimate goal, and also an easy-to-work place. One thing I would add about rules and regulations, I'm going to be working with Ms. Russo from Department of Children and Families. As it relates to all the many rules and, you know, have they been updated recently? Is there a lot of duplicates, and how might we do that? When I meet with her, I'm going to offer up two people from the committee to help her work on that. And I know there's a couple of you that have raised your hand and asked for that, so we'll be getting back to you so that we can look at them together and make sure now that it's got a good view of the knowledge she has, the things we're trying to accomplish, and that'll be on the back side of this because there are some rules there that haven't been looked at since 1992. And I started looking at them, and I think Jason just wanted me to call Debbie and get out of his office. But he's been extremely helpful in trying to explain what they are and why do we have them and are they duplicate and are they the same for a private provider as they are for another provider. So we're going to work on that as well, and Kathy alluded to that. What's going to happen next is we're going to bring it up for a vote. Not today, next week. So when I say this is really and truly the last opportunity you'll have to change anything or discuss anything, I mean it. So take a look at this last draft. See if there's anything that needs to be discussed. If it is, by all means, let's bring it up. I think we've spoken to just about everybody in the state of Florida. There isn't many left that haven't had input on this. But are there any questions on this draft for today? Any questions? Calling to question. Representative Coley, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Is there a definition of substantial for substantial compliance? Did I just miss that in the...
No, you didn't. Representative Coley, you did not miss it, and we will show you where it is. I had the exact same question.
Good.
And so Kathy will jump to the page and give you the line number. And
line 67 actually starts on 70, and it says substantial compliance means for the purposes of programs operating under VPK, school year VPK, summer VPK, and school readiness. That's what those references are. Adherence to adopted standards that are sufficient to safeguard health and safety, and then it identifies the limits for this purpose, okay? For the purpose of these three programs, it is limited to, at the line 75, supervision, transportation, access, health-related requirements, and so forth. Now, behind each of those phrases is a list of standards, and that is what Chair O'Toole was just referring to. When we were going through this list, for example, if you look at their standards related to food and nutrition, it's a pretty long list of standards, and so we'll undertake the effort to review those.
Okay, good.
Representative Atkins, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is in the same vein of questioning as Representative Coley. So we're talking about adopted standards based on requirements found in Statute 402.305. Are those the rules, then, that you're talking about?
Okay. Yes, yes, they are. They are the rules.
Another question that I have, it's two places in the bill. It's line 797 to 803 and 1794 to 1801, dealing with the mandatory CPR and first aid training. And so we're requiring all of the instructors and all of the school personnel to have this training. My question is, and I think in one place there's a reference to that it has to be within 30 days, but then there was another reference that instructors hired on or after January 1, 2015 must complete this training before beginning employment. And so when you think about what happens in the real world, sometimes teachers call in sick, sometimes teachers quit, like on the spot, and they don't get the 2 weeks notice. So if we could perhaps look at that, I don't want to put these providers in a position that either that they don't have anybody to be in that classroom. There might be a couple of ways we could solve this. As long as there's someone in the classroom, let's say you're forced to get a substitute teacher, but if there's someone that can be in that classroom who already has that training, or I'm sure there's a number of ways, but I think that there's at least two problems. One is you've got to deal with the substitute, the day-to-day happenings that are going to occur, and then the second is requiring that training be done before employment, I think, is problematic. I think we all probably have experiences that somebody's taken a job, and then the day they're supposed to show up, they either don't show up or they call, and then you're in a lurch. So if we could take a look at those two sections, both for instructors and for school personnel, I think that would be helpful.
Thank you. And we have a couple of lines we'd like to refer you to. Go ahead, Kat.
The other
green is go.
Okay. This appears on line 800 and also 1800, and they're written differently. The way it's written on 1800 is the way it should read for both. So that's a Scrivener's error for us that we'll correct. But I think you may still have some of the same kind of issue, Representative Atkins, even with the way it's written there. So
we will take a look at it. But as a parent, either the owner or someone who's there every day really needs to, because we can't tell a child that runs into some sort of first aid problem, wait in 30 days or in a week, someone will be here and you'll be okay. So we will take a look at that, and I appreciate you bringing it up. Any other questions? Representative Belecker, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do appreciate this process and the openness of the process, and I think Jason as well has wanted to escort me out of his offices between my emails and my comments, and I really think it's been a terrific process of getting everyone together and the feedback. Just a generalized comment, because I still, the areas I'm focused on and have concerns on is the VPK area. You know, overall, I just want to make sure we're not creating a regulatory framework that creates additional regulatory restrictions that are greater than our other choice programs that are so successful in our state, such as McKay and corporate scholarship. I also have a concern, and it is personal, on the faith-based providers, as my kids are still attending faith-based providers, VPK, and have had exceptional experiences with that, is that we're looking at creating a greater regulatory burden and really still coming to grips with the need, because I think in these choice programs, again, the greatest regulatory body is the parent, and they do have skin in the game on these VPKs. It's only covering part of the tuition, and they're there every day taking their kids to school. So I don't want to underestimate that. So it continues to be an area I'm providing feedback on, and appreciate all of the all of the listening.
I appreciate it, and consider it noted. Anyone else? Representative Saunders.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm also really excited about the draft. I had some questions about the third way here on getting to the standards, and after hearing it discussed and vetted, I know there was some angst about the second or the last draft and how we were getting there, and I think this is really innovative, so I wanted to commend the staff and whoever came up with that. I also wanted to give a shout-out to the change that we've made that was very simple. I think I had proposed something really complicated, which was like some sort of database warehouse of providers and who was a bad actor and who wasn't. And I think Kathy or Jason or somebody just came up with the idea that we can simply just change provider to operator and place that sort of tracking on the person. And my concern there had been that you shouldn't be able to have your license pulled, go open a new LLC, and get a new contract right away. And I think we solved that problem here, which is really cool. The three recommendations that I just wanted to share with the committee that I've shared with staff already and the team at the Office of Early Learning, and thank you and Liz for dealing with me through this process, were that I feel like there can be a couple of extra layers here. Right now we make really clear that if someone is a level one violator, that their contract is subject to being pulled with the discretion of the office who works closely with them. I felt like there may be a level two threshold that we want to take a look at. In other words, we may be able to see before you take this egregious act that you have sort of are on the path to that. And I think the recommendation I made is if you have six level two violations in 18 months, that might be enough for us to say, you know what, before something really bad happens, we should have a safety net in place to be able to pull your contract. And I think we're studying that, so we may have some data about what kind of providers are hitting that threshold. The second recommendation I wanted to make to the committee is that we consider a parental notification upon acquiring probational licensure status. So for our licensed providers, that is something that's happening right now. You can be put on probation because you've hit too many thresholds of violations. And while we are providing, or we are requiring here, that you notify a parent every time there's a violation, I kind of think of probational licensure as that next threshold that's worth letting somebody know about. As a parent, I might not pull my kid out of a program because they get one or two violations, the daycare. But if all of a sudden I know you're on like a watch list and the state is watching you and what you're doing, that might be something I really want to know about. And then the third recommendation I'd like to make is that we ask the Office of Early Learning to study the kindergarten readiness assessment. I think there's three areas that we've, as a committee, discussed places where there may be inequities in that. And I've brought up the absenteeism issue. Right now, it seems like you can be absent from a program a third of the time, and that accountability measure that kicks in once you take the kindergarten readiness assessment still applies. That felt like maybe it should be tweaked or at least looked at. The second was the language issue. You don't have to be taught these programs in English, but you have to be tested in English, and there's a disconnect there that providers complain to me about. And then Representative Fullwood raised a concern about the kindergarten readiness assessment and the timing of it. We had a conversation about that earlier today. So if maybe the office was willing to just kind of dig in a little more deeply, look at whatever data is available, and come back to the legislature next year with some thoughts, we could find value in that. But thank you again for taking my input and my being pesty.
Yeah, well, thank you, Representative Saunders. And we do have an agreement with OEL that we're going to pilot. We are going to teach in English because that is the language of the country. Most of the centers I went to, they were teaching in English. Children come from pure Hispanic homes with grandmas and moms and dads. And the question is it fair to hold accountable the VPK provider if they do within 30 days they don't test real well? What I'm trying to find out, and I think Shan has agreed to, we'd like to do two pilots, probably one in Miami and one in Groveland, Florida, which is mine. And that is, I would like to test those children, I don't care if it's 30 days or 60 days, in both languages. If they fail in English but pass in Spanish, they've got the material. And we just have to identify in kindergarten that these children have needs to have work on their English-speaking language. So I think that'll give us the data. Now, the risk to the locations is if you're not teaching in English and the children are not getting the information, then they're going to fail and those dings will be appropriate. But I think you've agreed that we will do a pilot, and let's look at the data, and we'll do a fair amount of centers that will say, let's just test these children in both. And on behalf of the K-12, which I'm not speaking for Representative Atkins or any of the teachers, many of them say that 30 days is plenty of time to see if they're going to make it in kindergarten. So I think we'll leave that alone for the year. We'll go with the 30-day, but then we'll take a look at it next year. But that is, I don't know how we get that in the language, but I'm sure Kathy will figure it out so that we can make sure that everyone understands that that's the deal we're doing. And I think my gut tells me we're going to be very pleasantly surprised that these children are ready. They just have an English language problem and then not ding the schools. That means they taught them properly. So we are going to work on that. But thank you for your recommendations, and those are also well noted, and we'll see what we can do with all of them, quite frankly. And I think, Representative Reed, you are now recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I received an email with some questions on this morning.
Only one?
This morning.
Gave so you a I lot have, of time, didn't
so
it?
So I have more than one
you
question.
You go right ahead, Representative.
I have a question about substantial compliance. The first draft, January 9th, required all private providers not currently licensed, including religious-exempt providers, to be inspected and licensed by DCF. This draft calls for private schools and exempt providers to substantially comply with the minimum standards and does allow the department or local license agency access to monitor and enforce compliance with such standards. How is this different from licensing? Will DCF write the rules for what is substantial compliance and how to measure compliance? Is it possible DCF will allow the accrediting agency to verify compliance and DCF will monitor?
Yeah, go ahead.
Representative Reed, with all due respect, the first draft did not require everyone to be licensed. It required you had to either be licensed or accredited by a body that met or exceeded those standards. So what we've done is, I guess the best way to look at it is taken a subset of the existing licensure standards that apply to health and safety. And, yes, DCF will have a rule and require that all providers are either licensed or meet that substantial compliance or are a public school. And there is nothing in this bill that would authorize an accrediting body to substitute for that substantial compliance.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. And it, Representative Reed, if you need to have the actual line numbers and so forth to answer that question, if you stop by, staff will point them out to you. Anyone else have questions? Yes, no, no, I'm glad you did, and I'm glad you got an answer here as well. Because as you all know, any other questions on early learning?
Yes.
Yes, sir. Representative Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that we're really not addressing curriculum. I just wanted to bring it up quickly, though, at my tours of some of the centers, the great disparity in what was being taught and how it was being taught. And I think that we have to look at what is age-appropriate curriculum, I know, and how do we enforce that? How do we encourage that without getting it, delving into mandating a certain type of curriculum? But I think it's just important because I saw 3-4-year-olds being taught stuff that 5- or 6-year-olds would be taught, and there was no comprehension at all, at least in my opinion, that these kids were learning anything. Just real quickly, one of the other things is we maybe look at that at some future time is been listening to some lecture series and people talking about music in education, and I've got a handout for everybody on some just one study, and there's a lots and lots of studies that show music and the benefits in doing that at the earlier age. So most of the education system, if there's music at all, it's brought into middle school, high school, and I think we need to look at, I think Early Learning Coalition and some of the studies that show will show that it's probably one of the biggest things that we can do in Early Learning Coalition from a curriculum standpoint. So I've got to hand that handout I can give out to other people. Sometime I think we'll have some experts come maybe and give us some testimony on the benefits of that. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Perry. There is no question that there is more that we can do. Last year we passed some changes. This year we're going to pass some more. And next year some others. And I think Shan wanted to make a comment on the education curriculum that exists today and what those standards are.
Good morning.
Good morning. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I don't see red yet.
Green.
You're not on, Shannon. It needs to be green.
See, but it's only red.
No, no, but you, no, hold your...
Okay, now, thank you.
See, it's a miracle.
good way to start the day. We have the statutory requirement to review and approve curriculum for any school readiness provider. And that curriculum criterion is pretty broad. We're looking at developmentally appropriate practices and that it aligns with the appropriate age-appropriate standards. For the VPK program, we stay out of the provider's business about what curriculum they choose, other than it must be aligned with the standards and developmentally appropriate, until they get in the cycle where they're not meeting the state's accountability level of having kids ready for kindergarten. Then they have some choices. They have to select an approved curriculum by us or do a professional development plan, and that approval process is much more rigorous. We look for very explicit instructions to the teacher so that there isn't, the concepts don't get lost. So we think we have both of those bases covered. We will have the list of approved school readiness curriculum before the beginning of the 14-15 year.
Okay, thank you. And Kathy has a line in the bill she'd like to recognize so that you can take a look at it as well.
Representative Perry, if you look on line 1674, it's on page 67. This is in school readiness, and it talks about instruction or curriculum, and specifically on line 1679, it mentions music. So maybe you could have some of those folks review this section and then bring us any suggestions they might have to strengthen it.
And if I might add, Representative Perry, some of the places I was in, they had music and lights and colorful pictures and all the rest. I think it comes down to an inspection process, and we didn't go into inspection very deep this time. We just didn't. And it would be impossible because, as you recall, we have 6,000 of them, and we have 6,200 and some odd in VPK and 9,000 in school readiness. So in order to inspect that many on a regular basis to see if they're doing what they should do, it's going to be a challenge. But we're going to get there because we're going to write the rules, make them simple, simply understood, and we're going to look at the inspection. We're going to take away rules. If you cannot inspect what you expect, get the rule out of there, because there's some that is one that just jumps out at me, and I'll just share it with everybody. It said that if you have a night program, no, they should not fall asleep. Well, how are you going to find out if someone fell asleep? You're going to go ring the bell at 11 o'clock at night, and you're going to wake them up? They're awake. They're not asleep. So who's going to report that they're asleep? So, again, some of these are older and need to be relooked at and reworded, and we have the commitment from DCF to do this. Every single day, I see something come across my desk that DCF is responsible for. And I just wonder if there's a whole lot too much on that plate, whether it's foster care, whether it's early learning. I mean, they are homeless children. They have a lot on their plate. So I want to go through those rules. I want to count, as Representative Bielecki said, on the people that are running these places to do the right thing for children. And parents need to be involved. But sometimes our poorest of parents don't know what to look for. So I want a balance between laws and rules that are good and safe for children. But I hope you all agree that on this particular endeavor, we achieved what we set out to do, which was health and safety. And everyone on this committee participated. And just about everybody out there participated. Is it the perfect bill? There is no such thing, period. And we're going to continue to work on it and take people's input and do what we need to do with it to make it a perfect bill. But I do appreciate everybody that has been here. Is there anyone else? Last call. All right. Let's talk about next step and next week. Can you believe next week is the third week of our committees already, and then we'll be going into session? Let's just go back to the last meeting we had when Commissioner Stewart stood up there for a good long time and answered all of our questions, and everybody was advised you had a handout. Would this suffice for any questions you would encounter when you went back in your district? I won't ask for a show of hands, but hopefully some of you had questions and went back to Commissioner Stewart or came into the staff. You've all gotten an electronic copy that you can take out and display anywhere you want to go on that material. She's coming back. I think the plan is that on February 18th, the Board of Education will agree with her decisions and recommendations. If they do, she'll be back here on February 19th, at which time I think the decision is pretty made. It's going to be heard out of this committee, and Janet Atkins is going to take the lead on the final pieces that need to be done as a PCB, which will include the instructional material. So we're making progress on that one, and then we will be putting this in its final form. And we'll be trying to get this to the floor as a PCB and get it heard. And before you know it, everybody will be working all of March and April. We'll be done. We can just sit back and watch all the work fly. Somehow I have a feeling there'll be more. We do have some comments from the general public. And first, it's Brittany Burton. And Brittany is with the Children's Council, and she has spent countless hours with us. And I thank you.
There we go. Thank you so much. I wanted to take just a moment to thank Chair O'Toole and all the committee members for making this such an open and inclusive process. As you indicated, the changes, and Kathy and Jason and Gavin have been wonderful to work with. You really did take the time to hear our concerns, to address many of the challenges that we saw with some of the initial draft. Really want to personally thank you in particular on the changes related to the Relia Wilson Act. As we talk about health and safety and welfare of our youngest children, that was an important little loophole that existed in law, and appreciate you closing it. The whole foundation and approach for making sure that children are in healthy, safe environments, especially those who accept public funds, and thank you for your attention on that, and also the tweaks that you have made on closing the school-age care issue and making sure that we can serve children until middle school entry, which is critically important, and the addition on the disabilities and making sure that children birth to 5 in our special needs populations have the services and supports they need. So just wanted to say thank you all. Appreciate all the time and attention you have spent last session and this session on early learning. Certainly is helping us move the system forward, and really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And then we have my favorite, Ted Granger. Where is he? Come on up, Ted. And while he's walking up, you know the answer to the question already, right?
I think I do. I read the bill.
Thank you, Ted. You're recognized.
And it works. It works.
Okay.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. I would just ditto everything that Brittany said. As Kathy was going through the changes, you saw how many changes and improvements to bill were made, and it took a lot of time, a lot of listening, and a lot of hearing, a lot of concerns from all of you, but particularly you two. Thank you very much. We were pretty excited about addressing quality this year coming into session, and look forward to addressing that with you next year. But we recognize that the health and safety is the foundation for everything about quality. And so really appreciate you addressing that and setting that foundation for future discussions about how we continue to improve the system. So thank you very much for all your work, and I hope we can get this out the first week of session so I can go home. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that's all we have on that subject. Are there any other general subjects anyone would like to touch on? For the gentleman in the audience and for the gentleman up here, you know what's coming tomorrow is Valentine's Day. And so I tried to remind you all by giving you a little red heart of candy. And women, the same goes for you. You know, you have to give one. And whether you buy a bone for your dog or you buy something for your cat, everybody have a very safe trip home and a good Valentine's Day. And this is a good one because you get to eat what work you do. You know, it's not like Christmas and you have to give away what you've done. And members in the audience, thank you once again. And with that, Representative Atkins moves, we rise.